Welcome to the This Is Money show in partnership with NSNI, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Alongside Simon Nye is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And this week, a flood of emails from readers on a very similar theme. And no, it's not the fact that there's not one, but three women on the new £10 note, nor the fact that the banking crash has made us all 20 grand worse off, apparently. Though we will, of course, touch on those. No, it's how do you give your money to your kids or grandkids while protecting it from the tax man, or worse, their partner? And actually, should you control what happens to the money you give? Also, 10 years on from Northern Rock, who lost out, what's changed, what stayed the same, and what, if anything, have we learned? Talking of learning, could you pass your driver's theory test now? I hope Simon and Rachel have been swatting up as I put them to the test. And if I've said it once, I have said it a million times. If something sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. So what gets my attention this week? All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
But first, you guys ask the questions. This Is Money delivers. And one hot topic this week, and I'm rather curious to know why, relates to giving money to your kids or your grandkids. Now, what your readers want to know specifically, though, Simon and Rachel, is how can you make sure that the money you give goes to where you want it to, if indeed you can? So not to the tax man or to a partner or indeed any future partner. One such email you got was, my daughter will give her son £100,000 to buy a house. But can we protect it in case he marries and dies and his widow inherits? So lots of ifs in there. Plenty more emails that you've been looking at as well. And Simon, we keep hearing more about blended families. So I imagine more generally this is an issue that's been coming up more over the past few years. But why this question specifically in recent months? Is it something we've missed in the news, or is it just something that is occupying our minds perhaps a little bit more?
I don't think it's an issue that is particularly occupying people more recently. I think it's something that is becoming more acute as time passes, and I'll explain why in a minute. But I think what we have been doing is we have received a number of questions like this, and then we've tackled them. And what we've seen is the huge amount of demand for people reading them. So any question like this that involves, I want to give so-and-so X amount of money, usually a large sum, but I want to protect it in some way, really chimes with our readers. I think this can be traced back mainly to one thing, and it's your favourite subject, Georgie Frost.
Oh, house prices.
Yeah, house prices. Yep. So what's going on here is people are being given large sums of money. One is either as a house deposit, and once you start gifting people that amount of money to help them with a house, then you start worrying about what might happen to it if something goes wrong in some way. And secondly, to do with inheritance. We are finding that there are a growing number of people who will be caught by inheritance tax, want to give away as much of their money as they possibly can, and if they survive for 7 years, it will be outside the inheritance tax net. And what is it that is driving so many people to be going over and above the inheritance tax threshold? House prices. People want to give away money, but they do not want to give away control of that money. They worry that it will be squandered, or another common theme running through this is the unreliable partner.
Yes, indeed. Well, I suppose if you're talking about inheritance tax and that is 7 years, there are lots of things to consider between now and then. I mean, we had that email then, if my son marries, if he then dies, if his widow inherits. But these are lots of ifs because it's a longer time period. There have been rule changes just briefly with inheritance tax, Rachel.
Well, they changed it, I think, perhaps for political reasons. But there is a new rule, which is that you can pass on a family home up to the value of 1 million. So we've got the usual bans, which is, what, 325,000 per person, 650 for a couple, or this new fiddly, complicated, annoying bit, not annoying, it's useful for some people, for understanding the rules, it's annoying. An extra bit on top of that to bring it up to 1 million in the case of family home. But you have to pass it on to family members. It works sometimes, it doesn't work other times, and it makes things a little bit more confusing with existing structures that people might have in place in terms of trusts.
Well, you mentioned trust there. What are then the options? What control do you have over the money, if indeed you should or you have any control?
So, it depends what you want to do and why you're giving the money away. Mm. That then clashes with this phrase that you will hear used regularly, to give someone some money in trust, or it's a trust fund. Now, that's an old-fashioned phrase that is generally, I would say, probably about 85% of the time used by people who haven't got the faintest idea what it actually means. It's similar to the old common law husband or wife idea, which basically just doesn't exist in the financial world. No. So the question of why you're giving this money away is important, because there is an element of control that you can have over it if, for example, you are doing something such as giving it to someone as a house deposit. So say, for example, you want to give your daughter a £100,000 house deposit and they're buying a house with their boyfriend who has a deposit of £10,000. What you want to do is you want to protect yourself in case that couple split up. Now, increasingly, that couple may be unmarried, so there's an extra concern, I think.
Does it make a difference if they're unmarried?
It will make a difference in terms of if there was an eventual divorce, in terms of how assets were allocated. But it doesn't really make a difference in terms of some of it, but it makes a difference in people's minds, because I think the marriage is considered an extra level of commitment. They think it's less likely that that couple will break up or something that will go wrong. So you're giving £100,000, the other partner's only got £10,000. What can you do? If they split up, you don't want that property to be split 50-50. Obviously, the mortgage would have to be paid back anyway, but you don't want the equity to be split 50-50. So what you can do is you can hold a property in two different ways if you own it with someone else. You can either hold it as joint tenants, where effectively the two of you just own the property, 50-50 split, or you can hold it as tenants in common, where each of you owns one share and the other one owns another share. Now, the default for that would be 50-50, but what you can have is a declaration of trust which says this person owns X percent of it and that person owns Y percent, and those percents don't have to match up, so it could be 70-30. Or you could say this person put in £100,000, this person put in £10,000. On the eventual sale of any property, the first £100,000 goes to them and the next £10,000 goes to them, and then the rest of it is split 50-50. Any gain, if they've been making equal payments to the mortgage, for example. Now, that does put in place an element of protection. Obviously, if that person then gets married and then gets divorced, and there are, particularly if there are children involved, then you might start to find a divorce settlement messes with that. But it still exists. It still shows a definite intent, and it is a proper legal document. So that is a way of having some control. Now, the other place where people want to give money away and still have some control is to avoid inheritance tax. Now, crucially, the thing about avoiding inheritance tax and lasting for that 7 years is that you need to have nothing to do with that money, really. You can't still own that money in any way. And once you give someone some money and put it in their name, effectively, they can pretty much do what they want with it. There is this concept of doing it in trust, but there are two different types of trust. And the laws were cracked down on this to try and stop people dodging inheritance tax. There's a thing called a bare trust. And a bare trust effectively means that, yes, it's a trust and there's a trustee, but you could do anything you wanted with that money. There's then a discretionary trust where the trustees have control over it. But for the purposes of avoiding inheritance tax, that's actually quite expensive, because there are tax implications that start to eat into it, because the tax man's not dumb. Basically, if you want to give the money away, you've got to give the money away. So in reality, when you hear people talking about this stuff, then you need to think about what they're trying to do, why they're trying to get control, and what the knock-on effects are. And realistically, if you want to give money away for inheritance tax purposes, you have to just give the money away. Trust your relative. In the old-fashioned sense of the word trust, you trust someone.
On your website, you have an article, "I lent my daughter £70,000 as a home deposit, but she since sold it and disappeared without repaying a penny. What can I do?" What are people actually doing though? Because obviously your readers are very interested. They're clicking on all your website stories. Do we know what's happening?
I think that we have an inherent queasiness about talking about money at the best of times. But then when you mix that in with thinking about death or thinking about relationships, the longevity of relationships, how long people expect to live, and when you, especially when you're talking about parents, is the type of thing that people absolutely don't want to talk about. I mean, I imagine this person who wrote in, lying awake at night, imagining should she give money away to the son, and then the son dies, and then but they've remarried, and it all sounds very convoluted, and it's easy to sort of raise an eyebrow at that type of thinking. But it's so easy to avoid those awkward conversations up front because, one, they're uncomfortable, and two, because when you're talking about family, you don't think any of this stuff is going to happen. I mean, perhaps you do in the case of unreliable partners, but generally, most people would think that everything's going to go fine with their relationship with their child or their relationship with their spouse. I mean, what we've seen from the questions that you've highlighted, both goes on. You have people avoiding those conversations, and then later on, terrible things happen, like the woman who's left destitute, she says, because she lent her daughter 70 grand, and the daughter subsequently disappeared. Or you have people lying awake at night working out what on earth they're going to do with complicated trust structures to avoid it. But it seems the lesson from certainly the examples that we're seeing is you've got to have those conversations.
But then the question is, how on earth do you have a conversation? And you've a really sad story. I have a terrible illness and our son-in-law is unreliable with money. How can we protect our daughter's inheritance? And I can imagine this poor person with terminal illness is staying awake at night worrying about this because she won't be around to see her daughter grow older. But how do you have a conversation with the daughter saying, I think your husband is rubbish with money, without causing a family rumpus?
I think it's probably better that way round than the daughter finding out later that money that perhaps she was expecting she won't receive, or that there'll be limitations on it. You've got to have trust that people are doing things for the right sort of motivations, and to be able to talk it through. Better to have a row over it and work it out and iron it out than people to be upset, disappointed later on.
I would also say, if you are worried about it, if you are dealing with large sums of money, then get professional help. Don't just make it up on the hoof. One, you might end up doing the wrong thing and it doesn't work anyway. Two, there might be options that you don't know about. And there is one other reason to seek professional help. Your well-laid plans may actually end up spectacularly backfiring, and you could end up incurring more tax than you would have done if you'd just done nothing. And that is probably the thing that you want to avoid above all else.
And if you do have any stories, anything you'd like to comment on this, or indeed any other topic, Simon?
Editor at thisismoney.co.uk. Email us any questions, or experts at thisismoney.co.uk. And we get a lot of them, but we will try and pick yours out and answer it.
Fantastic. Now, you're talking about large sums of money. The reality is that most of us will have somewhat less to leave kids and grandkids, or give them, as a result of the financial crisis. 20 grand less on average. That's how much worse we are, according to the governor of the Bank of England. 2.5 million lost their jobs. Some lost their homes. Most saw their pay flatline. Pensioners retiring on half the income. Savers earning just a fifth of the interest. Now, last month, we brought you a special This Is Money podcast, 10 years on from the credit crunch. Then we focused on the why, and I do urge you to listen back. But now I want to look at those figures I've just mentioned there. The impact on real people. Now, it was this week back in 2007 when it transpired that Northern Rock had sought emergency funding from the Bank of England. Panic customers, if you remember, they queued for hours to get their cash out. So where are we now? What have we learnt? And could it happen again? Well, yes, and very soon, says the New York Times best-selling author Jim Rickard. He was speaking to Rachel on the Big Money Question show.
There's definitely another one in the cards. Unfortunately, that's always the case. The 2008 financial crisis, the global financial crisis, was the most severe since the Great Depression. But it wasn't the only one. 1998, we came very close to shutting down global capital markets. That was started in Asia, went to Russia, ended up at long-term capital management. I actually was their counsel. I negotiated that bailout, so I had a front row seat for that one. But we came within hours of shutting every market in the world. 1994, the peso crisis. You know, 1987, the U.S. stock market fell 22% in one day. That would be the equivalent on the Dow Jones Index of 4,000 Dow points, not 400, but 4,000. So we've had these shocks before, but 2008 was the worst. So yes, I think we can fully expect another one, based on history.
So there's something inherent in the system that means that we are to expect every what's the cycle? People say seven, 10 years, something like that.
That's exactly right. And it's just, these are complex dynamics. Capital markets are a complex dynamic system. And that's not the model that Wall Street uses, by the way, or central banks or Wall Street or financial or the city. They all use these equilibrium models and regressions and certain statistical methods that really don't match up very well with reality. What does match up well with reality is complexity theory, which has been used in many other fields, physics and seismology and, as I say, meteorology in a lot of fields, has not been widely used in finance. I'm not the only one, but one of the people who's applying complexity theory to finance. When you look at it that way, it all becomes a lot more clear. But here's the problem. In 1998, Wall Street had to get together to bail out a hedge fund. In 2008, the central banks had to get together to bail out Wall Street. In the next crisis, 2018, perhaps sooner, who's going to bail out the central banks? In other words, yes, we've had a succession of these crises, but each one is bigger than the one before. Each bailout is more difficult than the one before. We're now at the point where the next crisis will actually exceed the capacity of the central banks to save the day.
Well, to listen to the full interview with Rachel, just go to thisismoney.co.uk. Now, I'll get onto this in more detail. Is this going to happen again? But first, I want to drill down to the personal finance stories, the personal stories. On your website, you've some really touching personal stories of how people have been badly affected. I mean, let's be honest, most of us have suffered pretty badly. But Rachel, tell us how.
Well, sort of regardless of what your life stage at the time, you will have been affected in some kind of way, whether it was redundancies or for pensioners. They've ended up with far lower returns on their savings, which has been financially crippling for some. Then you have people who bought property in those crazy days pre-2007 and have still not seen the value of their home return to the price that they paid for it. So people being stuck in their homes. And as you say, when you sort of drill down to the personal stories, that sounds top level pretty devastating. But if you think about the impact of not being able to move, families who outgrow their homes, there's a family who bought a home, I think in the Lake District, we have on thisismoney.co.uk. They bought a home thinking that prices would continue to rise, took out one of these bonkers mortgages that used to be offered by Northern Rock in the crazy days. The mortgage was worth more than the value of their home, so they thought that they'd consolidate some debt as well. Then the value of their home they expected would go up in time and they'd be able to move into a bigger property. It didn't happen. They weren't able to move their mortgage to another property when they had two children and outgrew their home. So they had to move to, I think it was Milton Keynes they ended up moving to be able to afford a property. If you think about the implications for uprooting a family, perhaps having to look for other employment, it affects everything, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other issues when it comes to housing, self-employed workers, older borrowers, we're hearing locked out of the mortgage market, first-time buyers have to wait 2 years longer to get onto the property ladder, 1.9 million borrowers who took out interest-only loans face selling their homes to repay them. Plus, we have around 4,000 bank branches that have been shut, apparently to cut costs, and loads of other issues here. Simon, your thoughts?
Well, the people who really lost out are, as we said, pensioners. If you were retiring and you needed to buy an annuity, then your potential income in retirement from the same sized pension pot as 2 years before the financial crisis was crushed, absolutely crushed, due to super low interest rates and quantitative easing. The effect that that had on annuities, which were a product that basically guaranteed you an income for life, was devastating, because they are priced largely on the gilt market, the government bonds,
but
and affected by interest rates.
But pension freedoms that came in.
Yes, but those pension freedoms were introduced in response to the absolutely devastating effect that had been wreaked on annuity rates. Savers also, again, tended to be often those who were retired or older, who lived off their income from a savings pot, used that income from a savings pot to boost their monthly income. So if you're on the state pension, for example, and then you've maybe got another pension that's worth about an extra £100 a month, then the extra little bit of income that you got from your savings account made a real difference to you. And savings rates down from 5-6% to, you know, 1%. I logged onto my internet banking the other day with Nationwide to be asked if this was the cash ISA I'd been waiting for, or the cash ISA of my dreams, or something along those lines. And it was Nationwide's Flexclusive cash ISA.
Good name.
Paying a handsome 0.75% And then also you had the people who did fall the wrong side of the borrowing divide. So if you fell on the right side of the borrowing divide, you've seen your mortgage payments absolutely slashed. Mm. There are some people who had interest-only tracker rate mortgages that were probably pretty much some of the riskiest loans you could take out, who suddenly saw the rate on their mortgage drop to below 1% and stay there. Those people are laughing. But it was the people who took out the 100% mortgages and then saw house prices tumble and found themselves in negative equity and unable to move. And we've done some stuff this week on places where house prices have not gone up. And the problem is that places where house prices haven't gone up tend to be the places that aren't very prosperous anyway. So you can't work your way out of it with higher wages and a better job. But also the people who took out the 125% mortgages. This was a mortgage with a personal loan effectively tacked onto it. And you could borrow up to 125%. I have a friend who took out one of these Northern Rock mortgages, and she was stuck in the flat that she bought for many, many years and regretted it for years and years and years. And also those people were then stuck, unable to remortgage to the new round of cheap deals that came out because they had no equity. And in fact, they were in negative equity right from the start.
Why has this lasted so long?
I mean, I don't know. I've never had a big financial crisis happen in my lifetime, as most people haven't. So you don't really know what's par for the course. But, you know, 10 years on does seem rather excessive, doesn't it? Especially when you think about interest rates still being rock bottom.
It does. But the bigger and madder the blowout on the party that you have, the worse the hangover is going to be. Basically, we had an unbelievable credit boom of gambling on this, gambling on that, reckless mortgages, slicing and dicing mortgage-backed bonds, huge explosion in the amount of money flowing around the world, in the amount of debt that people had, that companies had, that banks had, governments now have. And then it came crashing down to earth, and we decided that the best way to deal with it was, instead of allowing a form of creative destruction to take place where almost everything was raised to the ground and things rose out of it like a phoenix from the flames, that we were going to just try and put everything on life support of low rates and things like quantitative easing and hope that we could grow our way out of it. And there's a fund manager who I sort of greatly respect, Gervais Williams. His argument is debt for companies is effectively borrowing growth from the future. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the amount of debt that we built up, we borrowed an awful amount of growth from the future. And we're now seeing the after effects of that.
I'm laughing because it follows on from your party analogy. A friend of mine always says that getting drunk or having drinks is borrowing fun from tomorrow. So it's essentially the same sort of thing. But Rachel, while we were perhaps in as individuals having, you know, one or two glasses more than we normally would, it's not like we were glugging the champagne. Those that were have not seen, am I right, we've not seen any people go to jail over this. So what has changed? Has much changed?
What has changed? The Bank of England will say that there are all sorts of new measures in place to make sure that what happened before can never happen again. So the levels of borrowing that places like Northern Rock did on the money markets, which is where they got stung, just cannot happen anymore. And they say that should there be another financial crisis of that scale, there are systems in place to make sure that things don't go as terribly as they did, or that it couldn't happen at all.
But Jim, who you spoke to, says...
Well, yes, he does have different views to central banks. He's been saying for a while, I spoke to him, I think it was in November, and he was saying that something will trigger the next financial crisis. You don't really know what it was. His analogy is an avalanche and a snowflake. There's no point in worrying too much about what this particular snowflake will be. The point is something will trigger it and then you'll have your avalanche. But I spoke to him this week and he said, actually, I'm ready to identify the snowflake. And more than that, I will tell you when it's going to fall. So he said 6 to 8 months would be war with North Korea. And he's pretty sure about that. He's going to come back and talk to me in 6 to 8 months. So we'll see how we've got on with it. But he gave very specific examples of the type of rhetoric that we are seeing out of the US that is giving him a very strong indication that that's what's on the cards.
Given nuclear capacity, I think that's a very large snowflake. And whether that falls in 6 to 8 months, whether that indeed is the specific snowflake, he's not the only one that says that this is going to happen again. And some people suggesting this week that it's going to happen by 2020.
why can't we stop this happening? And how can we as individuals prepare? Because that's really what we need to know, right?
Yes. It's true that lots of people are saying it. To give him credit, he did foresee Brexit and Trump. He believes that there's something inherent in the financial system that means that there are highs and lows, boom and bust. It's built in. There's almost an inevitability about it. But the other thing that I think creates wariness is we're still in the aftermath of the financial crisis, both from the immediate effect of it, but also the side effects of the things that were done in response to it. We've got things like an incredible debt bubble has been building up through, what the Bank of England did is threw money at the system, thinking, let's just keep things moving. And it was seen as so precarious, the situation at the time, that the alternative was unthinkable. So they didn't really have to justify what that money would do or think too far in advance. And they never actually said, this is what we believe quantitative easing will accomplish. They just said, the counter is so bad that we're just going to get on with it. But now we are in a situation where we've got huge levels of consumer debt, of government borrowing as well. We're not in a position yet to deal with another crisis. So if something did trigger it, how are we going to deal with that situation? What central banks like to do when things get a bit more precarious again is to lower interest rates. But we're at 0.25%. There is really not very far to go. We don't have a buffer in place. So I think that's something that gets people worried. Jim Rickards believes that each crisis that follows on from the next requires a bigger bailout. So you'll have countries doing it, and then you have central banks doing it. And now he asks, well, who's going to bail out the central banks? The answer being the IMF, and that's a whole other story.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
Well, indeed, yes. Rachel's saying there about interest rates, the Bank of England as well this week, holding them to that historic low of 0.25%. Just two Monetary Policy Committee members, Ian McCafferty and Michael Saunders, again voting to raise interest rates. So it's been a busy week for the Bank of England. The new £10 note is out, but with the cost of living going up, women or no on the front, not much to celebrate with how much it can buy compared with last year, unless, and I await with anticipation, Lee Boyce's investigation whether some are worth more than a tenner. But we did get the latest inflation figure up again to 2.9%. So, Simon, firstly, let's look at some of those stats. The base rate quickly, will it ever rise?
Well, we are running out of time for my prediction of one rate rise this year to be correct.
So I should have said, will it ever rise this year or next year? I'm sure it will arise some stage.
So due to the fact that the Bank of England decided to start tampering with the regularity of interest rate decisions, I cannot tell you whether there is two or three left this year for me to be right. But we are definitely running out of them. I can tell you that much. I still think there's a possibility they might raise this year.
What would be the reasons against?
I think really just because I don't think raising rates would actually cause much harm. I think there's enough people on the MPC who don't really think it would cause much damage.
Then why only 7.2?
And I think it would be good to try and get interest rates up a bit so that we can eventually cut them again when we have a recession, rather than entering the recession with them at 0.25%.
In 6 to 8 months when we have war, yeah.
So I'm hoping we don't have war. If we have war, I suspect interest rates won't be going anywhere for a very long time.
Imagine so.
Inflation? 2.9%. Well, that means that if you do get your hands on one of those brand new tenors, it is worth 29p less than if you'd got your hands on a tenor this time last year.
So is it all linked to Brexit?
A lot of it, right. Yes. A lot of it is linked to Brexit. A lot of this is linked to the fall in the pound and it continuing to filter through. So what you had is that actually, obviously, the Brexit vote was quite some time ago. The pound fell very heavily quite some time ago. The pound has regained some ground, for example, against the dollar. Still down a lot against the euro. But what's happening is that all of those price rises didn't come in immediately, unless you're a company like Apple, who decided last October that they could whack an extra £100 on a MacBook. Most companies can't do that with their goods. So they hold on for as long as possible, and then eventually they put the price up. And that's what's coming in. And then you've got all the other things around the outside of it, clothing, petrol prices, airline tickets, things like that.
Have we reached peak, though, do you think? I mean, has it gone much further to rise as things stand at the moment?
Peak is tipped for 3% by the Bank of England.
It's pretty close.
I reckon we'll go over 3. I reckon we might hit 3.2. So but then you're talking to the man who said there might be an interest rate rise this year and he's running out of time. So
we shall see. You've got to be right on one of those scores. The £10 note as well. Just quickly, we've got not one but three women. Jane Austen, Her Majesty and Chief Cashier Victoria Clellan. That's a pub quiz question if ever I've heard one. So what's the deal with it? It's going to be like the new £5 notes. It's got those polymer things so you can stick it in the tumble dryer and all that sort of jazz. Is that right? Where we can get our hands on them? Apparently it's not everywhere. It's only like 32 cities or something at the moment. Or
yes, it is. So I know some of the answers to this. What's it like? It's like the new fiver, so it's kind of plasticky.
Smaller than it.
But it's smaller than the old one.
Yeah.
And it feels like the new fiver, but it's obviously a different colour and it's worth twice as much money. So don't forget that bit, people.
About 29p less than it was last year.
I know a man who has got his hands on one. A certain Mr. Lee Boyce, who went to the Bank of England first thing this morning in the name of money journalism to pick up a brand new £10 note.
I know that there is a
substantial amount of speculation as to whether there will be a bit of a rush on the low-numbered ones, and everyone's thinking, woohoo, collector's item, like the new fiver. I also know that there are a number of locations around the country where you can go and get one, and I would imagine that they will be showing up in people's pockets sometime soon.
10 to 7, Lee Boyce was there to pick his up, and it being one of the first hot off the press, he was, I think, secretly hoping for an AA0000 and then whatever three digits, who cares, because you could probably get slightly more than £10 for them on eBay at the moment. He said there was a queue. I think that there'll be a similar frenzy to the fivers, people trying to sell them online, looking for their phone. I would pay £10.50 for my phone number on a £10 note. I think that's a...
What, as a sort of one-time only use business card?
I don't know. Frame it and stick it up in your loo? I'm not sure, really. Maybe I wouldn't. £10.50, that's all right. But the excitement, once you've seen the first one, I think, from my understanding of the fivers, is it pretty quickly wears off and people get angry with them in just the same way as the fivers. I had a bus conductor.
Angry with them? We get angry?
I had a bus conductor I saw really growling at them because he liked to fold his fivers in half. Couldn't do it. Drove him mad. So
the things you just don't think about.
They didn't think about that at the bank.
Well, he's all right.
Nor the vegans did they think about.
He's got a little while left. Nor the vegans, indeed. You've got until the first half of 2018. Don't worry, you will get about 3 months' notice as to the exact date when they're going to lose their legal tender. But we're going to turn our attention to the time of the show where we flag up a warning, as we want to do on this show, and this time it's about searching for stuff online, particularly financial products. Now, please be very wary of some of the paid-for search engine adverts. So when I say search engines like Bing or Google, that appear at the top of listing results, because This Is Money was recently contacted by a reader asking if products called Fisher Income Bonds were a genuine place to put her cash after a house sale. Now, fixed rate bonds offering a top tier level of interest at 7.75%. Fixed for 5 years, they were too good to be true. Simon, it certainly sounds like it. But first, why on earth would you be Googling where to put your money?
Well, if you were in the market for a savings account, the first place that you might turn to try and find the highest rate savings account would be the first place that most people turn to find anything nowadays.
This Is Money.
Google.
Oh, right.
Yeah, sadly not This Is Money. Our traffic is not as high as Google. I would recommend that you went to thisismoney.co.uk/save, which is where our independent savings tables are to be found, updated as the best deals come out. But if you turn to Google, then you are likely to probably find some banks that you recognise. You will probably find This Is Money's independent Best Buy savings tables. But you'll also probably find some other stuff that you haven't heard about. And some of that other stuff that you haven't heard about might have some very eye-catching rates. Over 7%, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And you might think, ooh, that looks good.
Just give them an idea and of then how you much click through. Should be. Not should
well,
be, how much you can
basically
get normally.
The best five-year fixed rate savings bond is knocking around the sort of just under 3%, around about the 3% mark.
Right.
On a 1 year account, you get about 1%, easy access about 1% kind of thing. So rates aren't great. So if you see something that says 7%, it's not a savings account. It's just not a bank or a building society offering a savings account that is protected by the FSCS Financial Services Compensation Scheme for each individually licensed UK bank or building society up to £85,000.
But this specific case, the Fisher Income Bonds, your reader went on there, it said it was protected.
Well, now, there could be an argument here, depending on which side of the fence you wanted to sit on. To the normal, reasonable person on the Clapham omnibus, they would think that the information put on there was telling you that it was protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, the savings element, the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. If you read it really carefully, it did say your eligible deposits will be. Now, of course, they might not be lying because your deposits might not be eligible. And so they're not your eligible deposits. So there is actually potentially a little bit of sort of opportunity for mealy-mouthing there and weaseling. But essentially, it's not a savings account. And the only thing I would say, going on to Google and typing in something like fixed rate bonds or something like that, and then seeing something that offers 7% is so much outlandishly better than everything else, and trusting it is basically a bit like walking into a pub and saying to someone, anybody got any good money-making ideas? And then the bloke from the bar comes up and tells you about his good money-making idea. And then he tells you about it's all protected and everything like that. And you just think, yeah, OK, I'll give him your money. I mean, what would you expect to happen in that situation? So if you do encounter, and I'm not talking about this particular company, I'm talking about any scenario where you go onto the internet, discover something offering you seemingly outlandish returns that's claiming some kind of protection, don't just take it at face value. You need to do some proper digging into this, because if it sounds too good to be true, it just is.
Okay, we've just warned about this, haven't we, about something sounds too good to be true. But what if someone told you you could buy into something that's up 70% in 2 years at a discount and still looks reasonably cheap? Say hello, Simon, to Emerging Markets Investment Trust. Simon, before I get to the how the heck, I want to know the what. What is an investment trust? What is an emerging market investment trust? And then how on earth can we talk about these sorts of figures?
An investment trust is a form of collective investment. It's like an investment fund. But the crucial difference between what are called funds and investment trusts is that investment trusts are listed on the stock exchange. So they have a share price, they can be bought and sold on the stock exchange. And they also have a net asset value, which is basically the sum total of all the things that it owns, what that's worth. And the share price and the net asset value can be different, whereas the price of an investment fund's units will always reflect the value of what it holds. Mm-hmm. So you can have a scenario where an investment trust might trade at a premium, so the share price is higher than the sum total of all its parts, or a discount where the share price is lower. And that can be caused by all number of things. People might not think the manager's very good. People might not trust the sector or what it's invested in. People might just think that things are perennially risky and to be avoided. Or people might have lost all confidence in investing. So if the stock market crashes, you'll see discounts widen. Now, emerging market investment trusts have done rather well over the past 2 years. In fact, the emerging market investment trust sector is up 70% over 2 years, yet the average emerging market investment trust still trades at a discount. And some of them, there's one, Templeton Emerging Markets, up 90%, I think, was trading at a 12.5% discount the other day. So basically, you can buy something that's doing really well, but is trading at a discount. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? But the crucial difference between that and what we were just talking about is there's no claim being made here that your money is protected. So you could buy that emerging market investment trust, and it could go up by another 35% this year, and then you are laughing. Or it could fall by 35%. You have to make a decision based on what you think will happen in the future, because past performance is no guide to future returns.
Of course, but there's plenty of very well-paid people looking at this and what it's going to look like in the future. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts as an investor, as a personal investor, this is not advice.
This is just a
reflection upon my own investment decisions, is I like emerging markets, particularly the Asian markets, the growing middle class there. And I think that many of these markets are going to be the place where the world's growth comes from in years to come. And if you are going to be investing for the next 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, then these aren't a bad place to be, especially seeing as when you look at valuations, a lot of those markets look relatively cheap compared to the long run average, whereas you look at some other places like the US and that looks very expensive compared to the long run average.
All right, then, we can leave that to one side. Finally, I want everybody to be honest now. If you retook your driving test today, do you think you would still pass? What about the theory test for those of us young enough to have taken one? Insurer Aviva have done a little study, and they got 1,000 licence holders to resit their theory test using today's questions. Now, how many do you think passed? Well, it was just 13%. Now, if you think you're better than the 13%, This Is Money do have the quiz on their site, and they ask the 10 questions that people most commonly got wrong in Aviva's investigation. So do go on to This Is Money and try that out. Rachel, did you take this test?
I didn't, no. I'm too scared. What if the DVLA found out? Took away my driving licence because I can't answer anything about towing vehicles.
Yeah, I made sure I did it on the work one there.
We're not telling the DVLA, by the way. There's no way that they would find that. Please do take the quiz.
Take the quiz. You never actually took a theory test, did you, Simon? Because you just missed out. When were they introduced? Did we say July 1996?
July 1996, and I passed my driving test, I think, in April 1996. I would have actually taken it earlier in February 1996, but I was banned from taking it by my parents, who I think were concerned that I was actually going to pass the test only about 2 months after I turned 17, and they were worried about me being on the roads by myself. So they actually banned me from taking the test, not because they didn't think I was going to pass, but because they were worried I was going to pass. But a lot of my friends did take the theory test. And I must say that in those days, it was a little bit more like a quiz. In those days, it was really quite hard to fail the theory test. The theory test, however, has got a lot harder since in stages. And now, there's a very high, I think there's quite a high fail rate. It's really quite difficult. And I did take this quiz and I did fail this quiz.
Yeah.
So yes, I wouldn't have passed.
Do you know
my
what you got?
Test.
What was your mark? Because you had to get 9 out of 10 to pass.
I got 7 out of 10.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. I reckon I could have a decent crack at passing a driving test.
Yeah.
But I reckon I'd fail a theory test. The questions it asked in there, though,
Simon, you
if I'm going to be honest, we've had this discussion before in the office, and then some of the questions it asks in there are just not things that you need to know in everyday driving.
Yeah, to give you an example, and Rachel, I'm going to test you on this. A trailer, because we all have those, must stay securely hitched to the towing vehicle. What additional safety device must be fitted to a trailer braking system? A jockey wheel, corner steadies, breakaway cable, and a stabiliser. I have to be honest, Simon, I didn't know what any of those were. Rachel, your answer?
I don't know what any of those are.
Right, A, B, are they C.
Oh, let's see, definitely C.
She's right as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I got that one right.
All right, then.
But I guessed the question. The question made me realise what... Because it said... What does the question say? Read the question again.
A trailer must stay securely hitched to the towing vehicle. What additional safety device must be fitted to a trailer braking system?
So my theory was it must stay securely hitched, okay, and all of those other things had nothing to do with hitching a trailer to a car. So I said breakaway cable. But some of the other questions, which were things that you would never need to know the answer to, just weren't even possible to guess the answer.
You're towing a small trailer on a busy three-lane motorway. What must you do if all lanes are open? Have a stabiliser fitted, Rachel. Not exceed 50 miles an hour. Not overtake. Use only the left-hand and centre lanes.
I don't think you should overtake with this trailer, but I think you should stay in the left-hand lane as well.
She's good, isn't she? She's good. Just 49% of respondents in the Aviva study answered this question correctly. So, Simon, you got 7, but you never had to take it. And you passed in 1996. Me, on the other hand, was a bit of a late starter. To give you an idea, I'm about Simon's age. I only passed 10 years ago. And Simon, I got worse than you did.
But surely as well, they should be weighted. Because if you can't identify a stop sign, that's a problem. If you don't know stopping distance in a tunnel with a trailer and a four-wheel drive or whatever it is, then that's going to be more of a problem. Should they all have the same value?
I got the one where you take the wrong route and you find you're on a one-way street. What should you do?
But I got that wrong as well.
Oh, thank goodness.
So have you got that one there? Read
the answers. you take the wrong route and find you're on a one-way street. What should you do, Rachel? Reverse into a driveway, reverse out of the road, continue to the end of the road, turn around on a side road.
Turn around on a side road.
That's what I said. That's wrong.
No, because turn around on a side road is logical. Reverse back out of the road is logical because you're at least moving in the right direction. Reverse into a driveway. Well, if you can find a driveway, I suppose that's handy. Keep going.
Yeah.
That's continue
answer,
to
apparently.
Break the law. And that's the correct answer.
Exactly.
But what if there are cars coming at you?
Are you apparently just meant to keep driving into
them? Obey
the
highway code, or
yeah? So presumably you're the one, according to this. Yeah, I'd like to see you argue that in London.
What I should say to our listeners is that if you do want to have an argument with your computer, go to thisismoney.co.uk/cars, where you too can argue with the driving test quiz.
Can you do better than Simon? Right, editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard Strauss. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news and do the odd quiz. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. Follow us on Twitter or download the app. And if you like us, please don't forget to rate and review our humble podcast on iTunes.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.